People, it seems to me, like, just feel like everybody owes them everything, and they shouldn't have to work for it. They shouldn't have to certainly be in any way inconvenienced or anything like that. I think we have a real sense of entitlement in our world today. And the second thing is sort of a general state of discontent. People, when you kind of talk to people and things, one thing that's very common is people are not satisfied where they're at. They're not satisfied with what's going on in their life, and you know that there's an area or there's a way in which that's not necessarily a bad thing. But when it takes you to a place where you're discontent and it changes your attitude, either about other people or certainly about God or even about the situation in a bad way, then that's a problem. And so these two areas, we see it in our culture, the sense of entitlement and then this discontent. And in 1 Kings, we have an account of a king by the name of Ahab, and we'll give you just a little bit of background on him. If you're in 1 Kings, go to chapter 16. We're going to end up in chapter 21. But go to chapter 16. In the latter part of the chapter, we start with Omri in verse 28, who is Ahab's father. And we're going to learn in these next few verses some very, I think, important things about Ahab, and then we'll continue on. So Omri slept with his fathers and was buried in Samaria, and Ahab his son reigned in his stead. And in the 38th year of King Asa, so on verse 30, and Ahab the son of Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord above all that were before him. This is really reflective on the message this morning too, by the way. You'll see from Omri to Ahab that connection. And then in verse 31, it says, and it came to pass, as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, that he took to wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Zidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him, and reared up an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he had built in Samaria. And Ahab made a grove, and Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel to anger than all the kings of Israel that were before him. And then it talks about another event there. But Ahab here, if you'll notice Ahab, what's said about him and what he does. First of all, it talks about how wicked Ahab's reign was in God's sight. In God's estimation, and I don't know exactly how many kings were before Ahab, I didn't go back and count, but I think he's in this 5, 6, 7 area, somewhere in there as far as kings away from Solomon and that. But Ahab, he says, did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel to anger than all the kings of Israel before that were before him. Ahab was a man who was not a good king in the sense of pleasing God, but he was a king that almost went out of his way to provoke God, to turn against God, to do things that God would not be pleased with. And it's interesting to me how it's described here. It says that he was really not content just to follow the sin of Jeroboam. Now, you remember the sin of Jeroboam was Jeroboam set up an idol that was supposed to be representative of God in the southern part of Israel, and then one in the northern part, because he didn't want the 10 tribes to return to Judah where the true worship of God was taking place. And you remember what the result of that was for Jeroboam. God cut off Jeroboam, and Jeroboam became sort of the standard reference point for a person who would be displeasing God. And over, you follow through follow the sins of Jeroboam. Now, how would you like for that to be your legacy? The sins of, fill your name in there. What a tragic thing that would be your legacy. Now, we all sin, but to have that as your legacy. And Ahab here enters into that, and he follows that. And then he decides that he's going to worship Baal. And please think back on the morning message for all of this information pertaining to Baal. And so Ahab went not only from Jeroboam's sin, but now he's expanding that to the sin of Baal worship. And so we get sort of a background here to Ahab. In verses 17 and following, we see a lot of interaction between Elijah and Ahab, and we see some interaction there between Elijah and the prophets of Baal, that very famous account there, and so on. But when we come to chapter 21, we see Ahab and his, this account here of Ahab and his stealing of Naboth's vineyard. Now, if we could sort of give a little bit more information about Ahab right here, I think it's important. Because Ahab is, at this point, he's down in Jezreel, and he has a vineyard there in Jezreel, which is where Naboth lives. And Jezreel seems to be sort of a second home, if you will, for Ahab. Again, if you go back to 1 Kings 16, and you come to Omri, it says here in verse 24, and he, that is Omri, he bought the hill of Samaria of Shemer for 2 talents of silver and built on the hill and called the name of the city which he built after the name of Shemer, owner of the hill, Samaria. And so Omri built this presidential palace, this kingly palace, there in Samaria. And Samaria became the place of the political headship, if you will, of the 10 tribes for some time. And so Omri built this palace there. No doubt Ahab then, when Omri died, Ahab took over the palace. We see that Ahab goes back and forth from Samaria to Jezreel. Now, the house that was referenced here in Jezreel that we're going to read about here in verse 21, I think, and this is somewhat speculation, but I think this may be the house that is referenced in 1 Kings 22, the next chapter over. If you'll look at this, this is after Ahab's death here. It's talking about Ahab and his, it's sort of summarizing some things here. But if you'll look at verse 39, it says, now the rest of the acts of Ahab and all that he did, and the ivory house which he had made, and all the cities that he built, which are written in the books of the Kings and Chronicles of Israel. There's two things about there that I want you to notice. And first is, it says that all the cities that he built. Ahab was a very successful general. You remember he died in battle, but Ahab had some victories before that. And so it says that all the cities that he built, Ahab in many ways was a successful man. And then he says, and the ivory house which he had, which he made. I think that's very possibly referencing this house here that he has in Jezreel, because the house that is in Samaria was built by his father Omri. And so that's not the house that he built. So, and if it's not that house, it's something, a place that we don't know about, because these are the only two that are referenced in conjunction with Ahab. Be that as it may, Ahab was a man who had certainly not only everything that he needed, but much more than he needed. And the account here with Naboth's vineyard had absolutely nothing to do with anything that Ahab needed. Ahab didn't need that at all. But Ahab, I feel like, was felt so entitled that he felt it was his right to have that vineyard, which was very close to his palace. Be convenient for me. It'll be good for me. And it's possible that this vineyard was one of the nice ones. But at any rate, it was very convenient. But Ahab didn't need that vineyard. I mean, he really had no need for it whatsoever. But there's this, I really think, this sense of entitlement that he had. And certainly, as we'll read here in just a moment, Jezebel, his wife, definitely had that approach to things. And so let's read in verse 1, chapter 21. And it came to pass after these things that Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard which was in Jezreel, hard by the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria. And Ahab spake unto Naboth, saying, "Give me thy vineyard that I have made, that I may have it for a garden of herbs, because it is near unto my house. And I will give thee for it a better vineyard than it, or if it seem good to thee, I will give thee the money worth of it, or the worth of it in money." Ahab, I think, in his mind, is setting out a fair proposition. I'll give you a vineyard that's as good or better than the one you have, or if you'd rather, I'll give you money for it. But notice what Ahab's response, or Naboth's response. If I mix those names up, you hear them right, not as I say them, okay? Notice Naboth's response. And Naboth said to Ahab, "The Lord forbid it me that I should give the inheritance of my fathers unto thee." Now get what Naboth is saying here. He's saying, for me to give up this vineyard to you would be offensive to the Lord. It would be something that God would be displeased with. And the reasoning for that, if you go back to Numbers chapter 25, you can write that down or keep it in your head. Go back and check it out. It's where God is laying out, and he says, "I am the owner of this land, but I'm going to let you oversee it, and you're not to sell the land." And then if you follow on down, he says, if somebody's poor and he really needs the money, then you can sell it, but then at the year of Jubilee, then you can get it back and charge accordingly and so on and so forth. But God says in that, the land is mine, and you're not to sell it. It's to be the inheritance that you have. And I think Ahab recognized that and knew that, and probably Ahab did, but I don't know that. But Naboth said, God forbid that I do that. It's not right. And he seems to have understood that this would be offensive to the Lord. Well, Ahab obviously didn't care about that. He was following the sins of Jeroboam, and he was increasing that to being a Baal worshiper and so on. And Naboth rejects Ahab. Well, we're going to go kind of quickly through this, but you know the story. Ahab went home and sat down, wouldn't eat, and turned his head away from everybody and had a big pity party. And it's, oh, woe is me, and it's, oh, woe is me, because I don't get every single thing I want exactly the way I want it. Well, Jezebel's even worse, because she comes along and says, "Aren't you the king? I'll take care of this thing for you." You remember what she did? She said, "All right, this is what we'll do." She sent letters in Ahab's name to the leaders of Jezreel there and said, "Listen, you have this gathering, and you put Naboth up there as the sort of the person that's the center of attention at one of those deals, the guest of honor, and you set him up in this place of honor." And when he's up there and everybody's around and everything that's going on, hire two false witnesses to go against him and say, "This man has blasphemed God and the king." And then as soon as that's dealt with, you go out and kill him. I mean, that's Jezebel. Now, how hard-hearted is that? Killing somebody by treacherous means just because her husband wanted a a vineyard next to the wall. I mean, that's that. What kind of heart is that? And Jezebel, of course, we know about Jezebel and so on. And so they set this up, or Jezebel did, with Ahab's agreement. And it came through, and they ended up doing that. And verse 15, Jezebel said to Ahab, "Arise, take possession of the vineyard and of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give thee for money, for Naboth is not alive but dead." And so they have this conspiracy, and Naboth dies. Here's a little parenthesis for you. Prior to this, I don't know, 2-3 chapters in front of this, is the account of Elijah and the prophets of Baal. You remember Elijah and Ahab had all this running stuff going on. And Elijah, you remember he said, I'm the only one left. There's no way left. Well, what did God say? Now, I got 7,000 out there. It seems to me that Naboth probably was one of those 7,000. If not, he certainly was a man who was not willing to bow the knee to Baal, whether it's included to that 7,000 or not. But I think it's at least possible. I mean, it's exactly the right time frame and so on, that Naboth may have been one that God was referencing in that 7,000. I think that's entirely possible. And Naboth now, by treacherous means, is put to death. Now, if we look at this, we say, why did Naboth have to die? Why did Naboth have to die? I mean, that is a question that is one of the most serious questions that you can ever ask anybody. Because, I mean, if it's a question of life and death, that doesn't get much more serious than that. Why did Naboth have to die? And I think it really comes back to those very two things that I was saying. Is there was this sense of entitlement which said, I deserve to have whatever I want, no matter what it costs anybody else. That floods our culture today. I mean, it really does. And I, you know, welfare was set up for a good reason and so on, and it was a blessing to a lot of people. But, you know, there's some issues there that are absolutely wrong, and people feel like they're entitled to have anything they want, and at anybody else's expense. That's just one little example. And the second one is discontentment. How far different is this where Paul said, I've learned in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content. And it's not, I have learned whatsoever state I am, in spite of that state, I can be content. It's therewith, in that situation, and maybe even because of that situation, I can learn to be content. And obviously, and of course, it's because Paul was content with God. Paul was content with what God was doing in his life. And talk about the exact opposite of this feeling, a sense of entitlement, what Mr. Dean was talking about this morning in Sunday school, that list of Paul's. That's not the list of a man who's feeling like he's entitled. So I guess what I'm trying to say for us tonight is simply this. If we learn to be content, as Paul has said, in the state that we're in, because we're content with what God is doing in our life, then we will not have this attitude of, I deserve whatever I want at anybody else's expense. And if that attitude enters the church, it'll wreck the church just as assuredly as it will a life, and as assuredly as it did here with Naboth and Ahab, and particularly Jezebel. So learning to be content where we're at is so vitally important. And again, there's some follow-up to that, of course, things like does that mean it's wrong to try to get a better job or to do this or that? Of course not. The point with discontentment is that I am dissatisfied because I really don't trust God. And I'm dissatisfied with God because God's not doing for me what I think God should do for me, and therefore there's something wrong with God. That, to me at least, is the sort of the core of discontentment, and so on.